Over NBC's Coast to Coast network of independent affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. Now, to introduce today's discussion of Goethe and the unity of mankind, we present Robert M. Hutchins, Chancellor of the University of Chicago.
Mr. Hutchins.
Goethe was born 200 years ago. Celebrations are now being organized all over the world. In this country, the Goethe Bicentennial Foundation, with Herbert Hoover as honorary chairman, has been established. The foundation will put on a great celebration at Aspen, Colorado, between the 26th of June and the 16th of July, with Albert Schweitzer from Europe and Ortega from Spain, with a great musical performance for the Minneapolis Symphony, Rubinstein, Dorothy Maynard, Patagorsky, Milstein. Other celebrations are being held all over the United States in the principal cities and in the colleges and universities of the country. Joining in this discussion today are George Schuster, president of Hunter College, and Reinhold Niebuhr, professor of Christian ethics at Union Theological Seminary. Schuster, what is all the excitement about?
Hutchins, I think we may say, first of all, very simply, that Goethe was obviously one of the world's foremost poets, writers, and intellects. And perhaps it will help us to appreciate his significance if we begin with one of his own statements about himself. And he said, "I have always thought that the world is more genial than my own genius." It was his extraordinary ability to set his experience to flower in the soil of reality as a whole, which enabled him to surmount mere egotism and to find poetic themes, those, for example, of Faust or Tasso or the Walther von Schaften, which he could use to associate his quest for beauty and nobility with what mankind as a whole, regardless of nationality or preconceptions of a philosophic kind, was always seeking. His writing, which for the first time made German a world language, nevertheless always remained true to his own personal intuition. In short, after the manner of Dante, Shakespeare, and Milton, he became a citizen of the world who nevertheless kept his own freedom and dignity.
Niebuhr, what do you think about that?
I think that's a very good summary of Goethe's significance as a poet and a thinker. I wonder whether one could think particularly of the greatest of all of his works. Faust is an expression of the deepest insights of both Christianity and classical thought, and as representing some of the great problems that we face today. I think that Goethe's Faust represents a masterpiece that has really never been as fully appreciated the world over as it should be.
I think we ought to get Schuster to tell us the story.
Well, I suppose we could put it this way. Goethe is interested in the Faust story, which is an old medieval legend about a scholar who made a pact with the devil in order to improve his outlook upon reality, because he was interested in the problem of how a man can save his soul or work out his destiny in a world which is a combination of good and evil. So that Faust, having made his pact with the devil, goes through the business of discovering a young girl with whom he falls in love, and whose unfortunate death is caused later on by his desertion of her and her murder of her child, and then recovers from this having been plunged in sensual enjoyment and from the disillusionment through trying to make a place for himself in the world which will not be acceptable to his partner in this wager. In other words, he wants to create for himself a career which the devil won't like, and as a consequence, end up by having the pack torn into pieces.
Dr. Schuster, what would you say about the curious ending of the first part of Faust, that the tragedy happens altogether to the victims of Faust, and there's no tragic consequence for himself?
Oh, there's
Is there any significance in that?
I should say that the significance there lies in the fact that these acts of which he is guilty are, in the poet's view of things, steps toward the solution of his problem. He has to learn not through having justice done to him, but through the fact that he himself has caused injustice to others.
Well, there's one another thing we ought to mention, isn't there? And that is the activity in which Faust had been engaged before he entered into his pact with the devil. The activity was the life of scholarship, which came to take place in the area of more and more esoteric scientific researches until Faust was engaged in what would commonly be called magic or witchcraft. And then I think we ought to understand this devil a little bit better, don't you, Niebuhr?
Yes, I wonder about the devil. Of course, in all these great dramas in which the Christian and classical conditions are combined, you have pictures of the devil. This is not the real devil, is it, Dr. Schuster?
Well, it's a very real devil in terms of the basic literature of which Goethe used. It's surprising that he took over the medieval conception of evil and of the devil, which conception was that the devil is a rather farcical individual who, by reason of the redemption, is never really able to triumph.
When you say the medieval tradition, that's the medieval artistic dramatic tradition. Of course, it isn't. The devil is the negative principle in Faust. That's not exactly the Christian tradition of the devil in its pure form.
Take Milton's devil, for example.
Yeah, so Milton's devil is a Renaissance devil based on a great deal of later theological interpretation, and I think also somewhat on the witchcraft business.
But we ought to make clear what the difference between these two devils is. We know that what the devil in Faust is. The devil in Faust is the spirit who always denies. Now, what about this Miltonian devil?
Well, the Miltonian devil is, to a certain extent, a powerful incarnation of a principle of evil.
Yes, and also, Dr. Schuster, he is a rebel against God. I mean, that's the traditional part. That's where Milton's Christian Calvinism comes in, is against Renaissance or classical traditions. The devil is a rebel against God. That represents the positive principle of evil, as against Goethe's devil, who is the spirit of denial.
Well, the medieval outlook, of course, was optimistic. The devil was only able, as he is in the book of Job, for example, to do things that he was permitted to do. And in the final analysis, if God and the angels and Christ got any cooperation at all from the individual human being, the devil was bound to take his tail between his legs and go off home, defeated.
Well, this deals entirely with the first part of Faust up to this point. Now, we ought to make clear that there is a second part and that the second part has something valuable to contribute.
Yes, well, for my part, and of course there are so many ways of interpreting that later section of Faust, I think that what you have there is an identification of Mephistopheles with the libidos. He takes Faust through all the ramifications of knowledge and of power and of... he's already been through lust, and tries to catch him in one of these domains. And Faust succeeds in extricating himself by making his creative activity. As in
now, there's where I'd like to raise a question, Dr. Schuster. The redemption of Faust is through creation, the conquest of nature, the draining of the marshes, the building of cities. What Goethe is saying, in effect, is... pleasure is evil. Creativity is good. Perhaps the defect is that he doesn't recognize what we now know in a technical society where we've drained the marshes and the rest of it, that there can be a tremendous amount of destructiveness in creativity. Isn't that perhaps the real difference between his conception of evil and the devil and, let's say, more classical conception?
Well, let's try Albert Schweitzer's line on this and see how we come out. Schweitzer takes the view that Faust was concerned with magic, that he is shown as departing from it and saving himself to eventual contact with reality, so that the shift is not from science to draining marshes, as Voltaire would have us turn our backs on the world and cultivate our gardens, or as the utilitarians would have us provide for technological improvement and industrialization. It is a business of getting away from superstition, from witchcraft and magic, getting in touch with nature, living in harmony with nature, and developing nature for the good of the whole, which includes mankind.
I think that that would be correct, except that, in addition, Faust, as a play, seems to me to posit the relative lack of completeness that is involved in the term nature, because the play begins with a magnificent scene, a prologue, in which there is an evocation of those powers which lie beyond the realm of nature, against which is a sort of curtain the whole business of nature and human nature moves, and it ends the same way, with all these scenes of heaven and the ultimate resolution of Faust's problem through love. So that it isn't, I think, merely a question of sinking yourself in nature and by transformation of your egotism becoming altruistic, but it is also a realization of the fact that your finite or your purely earthly operations have as their ultimate corrective a world of love which lies beyond this realm.
Well, suppose we were to say that one of the great messages of Goethe for us today is the message of spiritual independence, that as Faust escaped from the magic and witchcraft of the Middle Ages, so we have today to escape from the social and economic witchcraft which is offered us as a substitute for individual thought and individual spiritual independence.
You know, Dr. Hutchins, I think that's correct, but I would put equal to the emphasis upon independence the emphasis upon wholeness, upon unity. This is what seems to me to make Goethe great as a thinker. He's trying, first of all, to bring the great classical Greek humanist tradition into unity with the Hebraic Christian tradition. There he, of course, stands in a great heritage of Dante and Milton. He has his own peculiar emphasis there. Perhaps it's more Hellenic and less Christian than Milton is, but still he's bringing this into wholeness. He is, secondly, bringing the Romantic tradition of the Enlightenment and the rational tradition of the Enlightenment together, as only a poet can do. He is a philosopher. Although he's contemptuous of the schoolmen of his day or the schoolmen of any day, nevertheless, he is a poet-philosopher who brings together the romantic tradition, which rests in feeling, and the rational tradition. And finally, he has the sense of the wholeness of the individual and the wholeness of a universal culture. I think the individual independence is always there. Perhaps that's his real greatness, that he wants a universal form of life that does not annul the independence of the individual, the uniqueness and the spontaneous goodness of any particular part in a world culture. I don't know that anybody has ever combined these two emphases better than he has.
The whole and the part.
The whole and the part.
Yes, Reinhold, don't you think that one could say this? He has an extraordinary awareness of the past in terms of tradition, but not much regard for it in terms of history. Which means, transposed into other terms, that it is significant to him by reason of what he can do with it, creatively and poetically, in order then to pass it on to others in a newly unified form, in the same way that every great artist does. So that to him, Greece and Rome are not subjects for histories, are not Mommsen or Grote, but these are materials, living, breathing, real materials, which he can then mold together with other experiences that he has had in order to enrich the experiences of others.
That's a very good way of stating it. I wonder, Dr. Schuster, whether one could say that he has been a little bit too much the child of his time, despite his great sense of the tradition. Isn't he a little bit the optimist of the 18th and 19th century? One thinks that his devil does not plumb the problem of evil. Tragedy is... There's tragedy there, but it isn't a really profound tragedy. The resolution of tragedy does not anticipate the kind of world that we're living in. Is there, for all of his greatness, a weakness in Goethe at that point?
Yes, I suppose that if you said that by contrast with a modern existentialist, for instance, whose problem is really this. Suppose that we take everything away from ourselves, every material possession, everything that we could have in any tactile sense, and ask ourselves, would it then be worth living? Would life be worthwhile then? See, that question, Goethe, it seems to me, never to have asked himself, because, as you said, he lived in the constructive, optimistic culture-building tradition of the classics and of Western Europe, the whole of the Middle Ages.
I shouldn't want to accept that suggestion without some qualifications. It's true that Goethe was born in a wealthy family and that he never suffered from any material hardship. But it is also true that he was deeply conscious of the French Revolution and the Terror. The Napoleonic Wars penetrated into his own house, and his own Grand Duke was chased from Weimar. So that we must be careful, I think, not to suppose that because of his serene nature, which comes down to us, that we can suppose that he was impervious to events that were going on all about him.
Oh, he was in contact with evil, Dr. Hutchins, but one might put the question this way. Did he recognize, for instance, that Napoleon was a symbol of French nationalism? Did he recognize in any way that the problem of the unity of his Germany would be solved by Bismarck? These are some tragic elements of the relationship of the particular to the universal that he didn't seem to have anticipated.
Well, let's try this Goethe and nationalism. Let's try Goethe in his own words. He says, there is something peculiar about national hatred. You will always find it most extreme and violent on the lowest levels of culture. There is a level, however, where it quite disappears and where one stands above the nations, as it were. At this level, one experiences a turn of good fortune or a disaster befalling a neighbor nation as if it had happened to one's own. This level of culture, he says, accorded with my nature, and this view of things had become firmly rooted in me before I reached my 60th year. Or take a statement like this: to achieve an attitude of broad tolerance, the safest thing is to ignore the peculiar features of individuals and nations, and to hold rather to the firm conviction that genuine merit has the distinction of appertaining to the human race as
a whole. If I could interrupt, Dr. Hutchins, that's exactly, I think that proves the point. He ignores, he has a spirit of universality that on a certain level ignores the differences. He doesn't really come to grips with the tremendous tension between what you might call the particular force in history and the universal.
Yes, but what I'm going to say now has, I hope, no implication that Goethe is not so great a man that I bow before him in reverence. But there is in all this just a little bit, I think Reinhold, just a little bit something that is pharisaical.
How do you like this? This is another quotation from Goethe. There is no patriotic art and no patriotic science. I think Hitler must have forgotten Goethe. Goethe goes on. Like all exalted good things, both belong to the whole world, and they can be made to prosper only through a general free interaction of all contemporaries, coupled with a steadfast regard for that which is left of the past and known to us.
Yes, if human beings would really carry out that dictum, even if Mr. Goethe himself had always carried it out, then the underlying philosophy would be correct. But the difficulty is that there are forces in human nature, tragic, dramatic forces of dissension, and of tearing asunder both the body politic, the family, and the individual, which, ultimately speaking, it's difficult to resolve in terms of a philosophy which is merely component. Sometime, somewhere, you would expect a man who had looked as deeply into life as this to get down on his knees and say, I can't do anything about it.
In other words, Dr. Schuster, his spirit, his devotion to the universal is right. His spirit of universality is true. What may be lacking there is a characteristic lack of his age, his inability to recognize the forces of recalcitrance in life, whether it's nationalism is against internationalism, whether it is the disruptions that come into technical society, class struggles, or what have you, the anarchic forces of life are transcended rather than overcome.
Well, take his views on education, or his views that are applicable to the state of education today. You have today a system of specialization, which has gone to such a point that I should suppose that we'd all agree that the uneducated expert is the greatest menace of our time. Goethe was not only a great poet and thinker, he was, in addition, a scientist. He studied botany, geology, physics, chemistry, mineralogy. In addition to that, he was a practical administrator and spent almost 10 years of his life in nothing but practical administration, designing roads and bridges so that the Duchy of Saxe-Weimar might operate more expeditiously and economically.
May I interrupt you for just a moment? One of the things that's always impressed me personally very deeply about Goethe was that he could run this bureau, this official bureau in Weimar, write all these letters without any stenographer, secretary, or even a dictaphone, and then have time and energy left to do all these other things.
I realize that is really a very important element in Goethe's genius. I just wonder whether anybody but a genius can be an anti-specialist like Goethe was. Do you think that has any special relevance for us poor mortals who are not in Goethe's category?
Well, what a genius offers us is perhaps an ideal.
But although he is almost the last of these great exponents of the encyclopedia in terms of the human mind, he follows a tradition, a pattern, which had been established for mankind up until his time, from Aristotle on.
Well, think of how much of his time he spent being an idol. Everybody that passed through Germany had to go to Weimar to see Goethe, and everybody who went to Europe had to go to Germany in order to go to Weimar.
I think, as a matter of fact, that the really impressive people about our time are the people who have some of Goethe's characteristics in this respect. For example, your friend Schweitzer, who's a great physician, a great student of music, a great student of the Bible, a commentator on poetry, a creative mind.
Do you think that below the level of genius we can do something with this in our culture, arrest the tendency toward a more and more fractional view of life, Dr. Hutchins?
It is my opinion that liberal education is not yet a lost cause.
I would agree with you, Bob.
The basis of this whole thing is the liberal education, which, well, we may not be geniuses, help us to avoid the menace of the uneducated expert.
Perhaps if we insisted that people be trained in this way, that they do not spend all their time reading all the commentaries on Faust, but some of their time reading Faust, that might help us to steer our lower levels of intelligence in the general direction of this passion.
I think what I might add, Dr. Schuster, I was a little bit worried about your phrase of encyclopedic. He was encyclopedic in knowledge, but I imagine what made him great was the quality of imagination which was able to weld this together. You don't really achieve this wholeness in culture merely by multiplying the disciplines. I think you'd agree.
Oh, yes. You see, here the problem is this. That Goethe surmounts scholarship by adding to it criticism and creativeness.
And poetic imagination.
That's right. Well, now, I think myself, looking back over this discussion, that a concept of the unity of Western culture, of the mutual interpenetration of Jerusalem and Athens, to borrow Gilson's phrase, was assuredly a noble one, and by it Europe lived for centuries. Now we see that division which was Christianity's from the beginning, of all races and peoples sharing and thereby transcending a variety of cultures, haunted Goethe in his own way and time. He steeped himself in the poetry of the Persians and refashioned it so that it had to, what it had to say in his own mature and magnificent Westöstlicher Divan, that's his poem. It, in his thought were blended elements of Islam and the Orient. And finally, long before others among his European countrymen had sensed the reality, he had thought of the Americas and of their freedom to foster creative cultural impulses growing out of a need for human unity.
I should say, Dr. Schuster, that the importance of Goethe for our day is, could be put something like this, that amidst the perplexities of our age, it is as important to remind ourselves of Goethe's vision of an integral community of mankind as for all men in their maturity to be reminded of the serene visions of their youth. Goethe stands at the youthful period, at the threshold of our modern era. He embodies the genius of that whole period. He incorporates more types of learning and more forms of spiritual discipline in his art than any other man of his day or of our day, for that matter. In that spiritual and cultural wholeness, he almost achieved the impossible. On looking out upon the world, he also sought for a culture which united the Hellenic and the Christian heritages and which would do justice to the genius of every part of a world culture. I think one must say that he did not, that was the weakness of his day, fully anticipate the difficulties which mankind would face in achieving wholeness, either in individual or in our social life. We are more seriously at variance with ourselves and with our fellow men than Goethe could fully realize. The draining of the marshes, which becomes the symbol of redemption for Faust in the second part of that great drama, has been accomplished in the technical age, but we are not redeemed. The evil which we contend, against which we contend, is more positive than Goethe's Geist der Stetsvernunft, that is, the spirit which always denies, fully comprehends. There is more groaning and traveling in creation than Goethe knew, but nevertheless, it is toward his vision of wholeness that we must move in every dimension of our culture and our life.
I should agree, and I should say that although Goethe lived in a pre-nationalistic and pre-industrial era, although he spent his life in a town of 6,000 and never stirred from a tiny section of Europe, he had universal interests and universal sympathy. He remains an inspiration to us because he transcends the narrow specialization and the narrow nationalism of our day. If the world is to find peace through world community, it must do so in the spirit of Goethe.
Thank you, gentlemen. You've been listening to the University of Chicago Roundtable discuss Goethe and the unity of mankind with George N. Schuster, president of Hunter College, Reinhold Niebuhr, professor of Christian ethics, Union Theological Seminary, and Robert M. Hutchins, chancellor of the University of Chicago, as participants. This week's roundtable pamphlet includes the full text of today's discussion and a selection of some of the writings and statements of Goethe. You will want to receive this pamphlet and to read the special supplementary materials. Be sure to write for your copy and send 10 cents in coin with your order to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. For $3, you may subscribe to the pamphlet for a full year and receive 52 weekly issues. Next week, the roundtable will present a special broadcast from London on Is the Marshall Plan Succeeding? Today's roundtable originated in Radio City, New York. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.